Good evening and welcome to the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Good evening. Welcome to CSIS. I'm Andrew Schwartz. I'm our Senior Vice President for External Relations here, and I want to thank all of you for coming out tonight. It's a beautiful night out, and but what better place to be than in our basement with no windows? Very happy to see my former colleague, Assistant Secretary Kurt Campbell. As many of you know, Kurt Campbell was here at CSIS for a very long time. He's a personal mentor and friend to me, and I'm just so glad he's here. I'd like to thank the Stavros Niarchos Foundation. As you can see, the Niarchos Foundation has graciously made this series possible, and we will keep doing it until Bob doesn't want to do it anymore, that's for sure. And, you know, speaking of Bob, in the United States, Sundays are about three things. They're about church, they're about football, and they're about Bob Schieffer. We got him here tonight for you guys right in person. Bob, take it away.
Thank you very much, Andrew, and welcome. I'd also like to recognize former ambassador to China, Jim Sasser, who's sitting right there, one of my close friends. Thank you for coming, Senator. Glad to see you. Well, the panel is a really good one. Kurt Campbell, Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs. He came to that job in 2009, previously the CEO and co-founder of the Center for New American Security. He was a professor at Harvard, associate professor of public policy and international relations at the Kennedy School. Chris Johnson, senior advisor and Freeman Chair in China Studies here at CSIS. His most important public service, as far as I'm concerned, is he gave me a lot of help in preparing for the presidential debate. And I'll be always be grateful for that, Chris. He's frequently advised senior White House, cabinet, congressional, military, and foreign officials on Chinese leadership and on Beijing's foreign and securities policy. Spent nearly two decades in the U.S. government's intelligence and foreign affairs communities. And Richard McGregor over here, Washington Bureau Chief for the Financial Times, author of The Party, The Secret World of China's Communist Rulers, probably knows as much about the internal workings of the communist leadership in China as anybody. We're happy to have you here, Richard. Well, the topic is obviously China, and I just want to begin by telling a little personal story. When I was preparing to moderate the presidential debates, one of the people I talked to was Graham Allison up at Harvard. And he told me something I'd never heard before. He said, in the history of the world, from the time of when Sparta was the reigning power and along came the rise of Athens, in the history of the world, there have been 15 such junctures when there was an undisputed reigning ruling power in the world and another power rose up in their time. That's happened 15 times, and 12 of those 15 times, it resulted in war, beginning with that first one, obviously, between Athens and Sparta, and that one went on for several years, as we all recall. So certainly we are at one of those junctures in history now. So Secretary Campbell, I'd like to just start with you to give us kind of a broad overview. Tell us how the administration views the relationship between China and the United States right now, and what do you see as the challenges in the years ahead?
Well, Bob, thank you very much, and it's great to be back at CSIS and to be with my friends and colleagues on the panel. Very much appreciate the opportunity. I think, as all of you have seen over the last several years, the Obama administration, and really a bipartisan spirit, has sought to step up our game in the Asian Pacific region to increase our diplomatic, our commercial, our strategic, and our political interactions really across the board. And when we think about, it's been termed either the pivot or rebalancing, a key component of that is frankly our desire to improve and increase our interactions and our relationship with China. We all recognize its importance on the global stage, and frankly, the region and the world demands that the United States and China make an extraordinary effort to make sure that our relationship is strong and stable and predictable. You referred to this long history of what are often referred to as hegemonic transitions. One of the things I would say is that the leadership on both sides has the benefit of that history to look at missteps that have been taken in the past. And there is a very clear determination on both sides to ensure that where we compete peacefully, and that we seek always to step up areas of cooperation as we go forward. I believe that one of the most important signals that the President has sent is that in the immediate aftermath of his re-election, his first trip outside of the United States was to Asia to visit our strong ally in Southeast Asia, Thailand, to make a historic visit to Burma, and to go to Cambodia for the East Asia Summit. And in Cambodia, one of the most important visits we had between the President and Premier Win Jiao Bao was simply put to underscore at this juncture the strongest possible determination on the part of the United States to continue the path of a productive relationship between our two sides. And we look forward to working with the new Chinese government just as President Obama has been reelected.
Richard, the Chinese leadership is now in place. Give us a rundown on who they are and what should we expect here.
I think the basic point of the leadership transition we've just seen, it's been very steady and stable. That's an achievement of itself. I mean, China still is in the early stages of institution building or finding an institutional mechanism for transference of leadership and the like. It was a conservative change in this respect. I mean, I don't want to break up individuals on the Politburo Standing Committee into reformers and conservatives, because that's a kind of very rubbery term. It's like putting a black hat or a white hat on somebody's head. But it seemed to be very much leaning towards seniority. I think the new fourth-ranked person, Party Secretary Yu from Shanghai, is 67 years old, which is really the age when you should be retiring rather than being elevated. Two people have been most active and outspoken, in promoting, broadly speaking, a liberal agenda in the Chinese context, didn't make it up to the Politburo Standing Committee, which is a disappointment for some people. Another person, Wang Qishan, who many people have put great expectations on in terms of an economic reform agenda, did not get an economic job. So in that respect, it was conservative, I guess, but also disappointing. If you want to look on the positive side from the a Chinese perspective, they reduced the numbers on the standing committee from 9 to 7. So if we have a system which runs on consensus, in theory, it might be less clogged. It might be more efficient. The one notable sector which was dropped from the 9 was the so-called Politics and Law Committee. It's very important. Politics comes before the law in China. and that is also the security state operates under that. And for whatever reason, because whether the previous person sitting in that job had been too much, had gone too far, whether they thought it had become too much, its budget demands had become too great, had become too powerful, too pervasive, that seems to have dropped down in the power structure a little bit. So that's interesting. But we also don't know exactly what portfolio areas all seven people will hold. So it's a kind of steady as she goes, and for China, that's a triumph. What they stand for, I wouldn't put too... one of the funny things about running for office in China, and this is where Bo Xilai got into trouble, is that he campaigned for office and made a big target of himself. He wasn't a team player. The way, generally speaking, you get ahead is to be a team player. In other words, don't pre-position policy agendas in public, in the bureaucracy. And there's a great emphasis put on getting on. So we can speculate, and I can speculate about what Xi Jinping thinks, but I think we're still, frankly, at the speculation stage, and we have to wait for at least 1 or 2 years before we get a sense of the direction of the government. I will say this, just one final thing, is that Xi Jinping, I would think, would certainly be a much more effective diplomat and representative on the world stage for China Hu Jintao was the ultimate functionary. I don't think he ever, and Secretary Campbell would know better than I, but he really didn't drift off the script at all. Xi Jinping is an altogether more ebullient human representative, I think, for China, and in that respect, that's got to be a good thing.
We'll talk about him a little bit, Chris, because sure. I know you know something about him. I mean, what an unusual background he
has. Yeah, definitely has an unusual background, and I think, let me just amplify a few things that Richard said. I mean, first and foremost, I think what we're seeing is a person who's kind of composed of two primary elements. The one is this privileged background of being a so-called princeling, the child of the founders of the regime, and having that privileged lifestyle for much of his early days. Quite heady, actually, after the revolution, growing up in Zhongnonhai, formerly the compound of Chinese emperors. You know, this sort of thing. So, quite an experience. And then, of course, when his father fell out of favor with Mao Zedong some years later, he also was sent down during the Cultural Revolution and was doing menial labor as a pig farmer at that time. So, he's had the high and low within their system. And I think that's what's interesting, and it's what distinguishes him to some degree from some of the other princelings, is that he did have that experience. So whereas the general public in China, I think, tends to be suspicious of these princelings because of the privileges, because of their family's involvement in business, things of this nature, because he had that common person experience. And he's seen as having that touch, knowing what the common Chinese people face. And I think this is true, frankly, of this entire generation. As Richard was saying, many of them had this similar experience, the kind of sent down youth experience. So there's a sense that they understand, perhaps, the challenges that are being facing common Chinese and the issues at the local level. That's another issue. Is she spent much of his career, in very local places. In fact, earlier on, prior to the rapid rise of these princelings in the last decade, there was, after Tiananmen, there was a lot of concern at that time. One of the things that fueled the Tiananmen demonstrations initially was the concerns about the advantages, the privileges of these princelings, and that was at a much lower base than they enjoy now. So at that time, there was actually an internal edict banning these people from rising too high. So Xi and many of his similar princeling colleagues spent a lot of time in very local places. So he's got a good grasp, certainly more so than Hu Jintao, who spent most of his career in the central bureaucracy. He was out in many of these coastal provinces and so on. I totally agree as well with Richard's point that this is a much more self-confident person, somebody, frankly, who is very comfortable in his own skin, will go off the talking points. I mean, his visit when he came here in February really, and it was described this way in the Chinese press, as a successor to Deng Xiaoping's famous visit in the late 1970s after the establishment of relations. And, he did regular guy things. He, he was willing to go to Iowa and kind of reconnect with the people that he had interacted with there. And he went to a Lakers game, which was seen as a very, kind of common touch sort of thing to do. These are things that, my sense anyway, Hu Jintao would have been mortified to do. So he's getting a lot in terms of style points. The question is going to be, is there more there than just style points? And I agree with Richard that we're probably going to have to wait some time. Mm-hmm.
And his daughter goes to college.
Harvard, yes, that's right.
Under an assumed name.
That's the theory, yeah.
can I say one other thing? The
sure.
other advantage, these are excellent points, but one of the advantages that we have is that for this generation of leaders, we probably know them a little bit better than we've known their counterparts before.
Really?
Yeah, so as Chris has indicated, Xi Jinping had a very long, by Chinese standards, and successful trip around the United States. It was hosted by Vice President Biden. Vice President Biden also went to China. He had previously studied, as Chris said, in the United States. Li Keqiang also has met regularly with visiting American and other officials. And probably, I don't know of another Chinese official, Wang Qishang, who's had as much in-depth experience with international diplomacy, who has ascended on the economic side, albeit, but who has now risen to such a high position. So these are people that know the world, and we've had some interactions with.
What explain to us this whole business of the pivot? Because, as I understand it, the Chinese have one idea of it, and we have a kind of a different idea of it. What is this pivot?
Well, look, you know, the United States has always been deeply engaged in Asia. For decades, we have maintained strong security alliances. We have had a key role in working with China as China came out of the Cultural Revolution. We have worked basically from Japan to Australia in deepening relationships for decades. I think the case has been that over the course of the last decade or so, we have been very engaged in critical endeavors in the Middle East and South Asia. And I think there is a recognition now that as we responsibly wind down some of those commitments, that in many respects, the lion's share of the history of the 21st century is going to be written in Asia, across the board, strategically, politically, militarily. And the United States wants to be part of that. We are going to be part of that that drama that plays out. Now, we have stated very clearly that a critical component of that is a close working relationship with China. So when we engage, for instance, Burma, we have our own history, our own motivations that are unrelated to other countries. And so what we are seeking in our engagement is to underscore the positive sum realities of what we want to accomplish working together. At every meeting we have with Chinese interlocutors, we lay out a critical set of areas where we can work together in assistance and joint endeavors that send a message that both countries are determined to work together in the 21st century.
Well, what do you say to the Chinese when they say, we think this is some sort of containment policy?
I say it's not.
No, I think there's... you can go on if you like. No, but I think also there's a lot of talk about the US pivot and the like, but also you can just as much say that, you know, Asia has pivoted, or whatever the word you might want to use, and China has as well. China had a very successful period of regional diplomacy in the 90s and early 21st century. In wooing and placating and seducing ASEAN countries in particular. They were well ahead of Japan in engaging with them on a free trade zone, for example, successfully called smile diplomacy. Well, that really has unwound rapidly from Beijing's perspective in the last 3 years. You look at relations with Vietnam, with the Philippines, with Australia to a certain degree, with Japan in a rapid way, in a slightly different fashion. So the U.S. has been lucky enough, in fact, to have been invited back. I can remember living in Asia in the 90s, during the time when Prime Minister Mahathir was writing books about Asian values and the like, and that was very prevalent in Asia and Singapore. And that really has all drifted into the background these days. And the region wants America back there. I mean, in what form and how you balance it, and the diplomacy that goes with that is obviously very delicate. But I don't think it's the U.S. rushing back in to confront China as so much as a diplomatic opening up for Washington in the region.
There really are two key features here to Asian politics. Every country in Asia wants a better relationship with China, and they seek it in all aspects of their diplomacy. But it is also the fact that now, as Richard indicates, really every country in Asia wants the United States actively engaged in the Asian Pacific region. And they actually believe that American engagement assists them in their diplomacy with respect to China.
How does China view all of this, Chris?
The strategic rebalancing?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I think they haven't, my sense is anyway, that they haven't fully come to conclusion on that yet. And I think this is one of the things that we're going to be watching for very carefully as the new leadership team gets seated. With the leadership transition, they've been quite distracted, fighting over the slicing of the pie and who's going to get what position and so on. And I think when the policy was initially enunciated, their reaction, their public reaction, was quite calm. You know, we welcome a role for the United States. We're comfortable with the United States being an Asian power, et cetera. Internally, I think the response was sort of more cynical, and the U.S., doesn't have the staying power, basically, to be able to continue this. I think that declinist meme has suffered a lot here in the last year or two, and is there are far fewer people in China making that case now. But what's missing is that typically like this, I mean, let's face it, this is a grand strategic move by the United States in the region, and as such, it requires a grand strategic assessment by China. And in their system, the absolute top leadership needs to participate in that kind of a debate. And my sense is they've been so distracted by this leadership problem that they haven't done so. And in the absence of that, I think what happens then is these more suspicious voices have been kind of controlling the narrative within China. So that's why we see this containment narrative very strong. And so what's going to be interesting now that the new leadership team is being seated, and it was interesting that Xi Jinping received kind of the two key party titles at once. You know, Hu Jintao had been forced to wait for the military position for 2 years. She was given all of them. So he will be fully empowered to make these kind of, you know, assessments at that very senior level. And so the question is going to be, how is he going to choose to assess what the United States has done, and how is he going to adjust China's policy both regionally and in the bilateral relationship to respond?
Let me just ask all of you. China's economy is slowing down. How is that going to affect China's relationship with us, and where do you all see that going?
I think it was slowing down. I think it's bottomed out now. It may have bottomed out on kind of easy credit from these new forms of trust banks where property developers can get loans. But I think it's an entirely good thing, and I think the leadership in China probably is much happier for growth to be around 7% anyway. I always think it's a very fake sort of argument or line that people say that China has to grow at 8%, otherwise it falls apart. You can grow at 8% and be building steel mills, or you can grow at 7% and be building an entirely different form of economy.
Right.
And hopefully, in theory, that's what they might be doing. I mean, I think China has got lots of growth left in it yet. And frankly, with the, you know, Europe in the doldrums, potentially for many, many years, the US still trying to reach velocity speed or whatever it's called, you know, I think Chinese growth is a very positive thing for the world and for trade.
What's best for the United States, a strong China or a weak China? Which poses the greater threat?
Well, I think U.S. policy has consistently been for decades that we support a strong China. And it's very much in U.S. interests and the interests of those in the neighborhood to see a strong, stable, productive, cooperative China. I think just to further put a point on what Richard said, one of the things that we will be looking for are some structural reforms in China. The United States is not going to be, in the same way it has been in the past, the export location of last resort. You need more internal demand inside China. So in that respect, it really is not so much, as he indicated, you know, the absolute levels of growth, but the direction and the kind of growth, creating a strong, stable middle class in China that can consume not just Chinese products, but increasingly exports from the United States and other countries will be an essential feature in the overall rebalancing that needs to take place in the Asian Pacific region.
Let me just add to that that I think this is the fundamental challenge that the new leadership team faces, is how to address these issues that both Richard and Kurt have highlighted. And I think it's fair to say that you do see a sense that they're increasingly coming to an assessment within the system that they are at one of these kind of key inflection points in their economic development path. They realize, I think, to some degree, that they have largely squeezed as much juice out of the orange as they can in the current configuration of the system. And not only that, but there's been perhaps just through unintended consequences some retrogression, especially with regard to the stimulus policies in 2008, where, like all other countries, they embarked on a large stimulus program. The difference is that the way the Chinese economy is structured, when that signal goes out from the top leadership, and the signal goes to the state banks, their response is to lend to state-owned enterprises because they know that the government will cover that bet. And so what we've seen, you know, after doing a lot of really hard work to clean up the state sector in the late 1990s as they sought to join WTO. We've now seen the state sector, you know, come back very strongly and the economy very prominently. This was a very strong debate prior to the party Congress, you know, how to deal with this problem and what they are going to do about it. I think folks, a lot of folks, as Richard pointed out, are disappointed in the way the configuration of the new leadership, because some of these people who have been stronger voices about dealing with those issues didn't make it. I'm actually more optimistic myself, because my sense is they've traded some of that reformist sentiment for greater unity among the new leaders, which means they might actually get something done, but we'll have to see how they do it going forward.
There's no question that we talk about our opinion, but China has also been much more assertive in the South China Sea and these various places, and we have these disputes coming up over these remote islands, basically rocks out there.
Maybe rocks with oil under
them. Yeah, with oil under them. We have treaty agreements with Japan. I guess the question I would ask you all, with the United States, is it conceivable that we could actually go to war over one of these, if one of these disputes got to that point, that we'd have to fulfill our treaty obligation?
My sense is that, I mean, this is a commitment that that obviously the U.S. takes very seriously. These are our treaty allies, and it doesn't just reflect on our own relationship, our own bilateral relationship with that country, or the definition of these rocks and so on, but our security commitment to the region, and avoiding, frankly, destabilizing results if our commitment to the region becomes questioned in some way. You know, nuclear proliferation, all the problems that you can think of. I think the focus, though, should be on what we're seeing, not from the U.S. side, but and not just from the Chinese side, but among all the players in these territorial disputes. I think we're seeing unhelpful actions in most of these places, and I think the thing that's of most concern and what could draw us into that kind of scenario, in the case of China and Japan, for example, with the Senkaku / Diaoyu Island dispute right now, there's a rapid escalation in tempo among these they're non-military, they're fishing vessels and maritime surveillance, and on the case of the Japanese Coast Guard, ships. But the point is, you got more stuff in a small space, which can really lead to problems, you know, if there's an accident. And the problem is that, as far as I can see anyway, there's no easy off-ramp for either leadership, whether it be Japan and China or China and the Philippines, because many of the other countries, the Southeast Asian claimants, for example, are facing the same nationalist pressures on their government that the Chinese are facing on theirs. So there's no easy way to let that air out of the balloon quickly, you know, if something like that happens. And then, you know, the phone starts ringing to various parties. So it's a very challenging situation. I think what we're doing, and the administration, I think, gets tremendous credit for this, is trying to go out and to use U.S. influence and leverage, to the degree that we have it, to be a calming voice and to encourage the parties to step away, you know, from these sort of actions and calm things down, recognizing full well, of course, that these sovereignty issues aren't going to be solved anytime soon. But, you know, let's take active steps to get the more troublesome elements under control.
What is actually our policy on this?
Well, let me just, at a broad level, I think it would be our view that we want cooler heads to prevail at this moment. I will say that many of these issues have been around for decades. They are not new, and they have flared periodically over a period of decades. It is also the case that remarkable prosperity has taken place in Asia, even with these problems lurking sometimes just beneath the surface. And what we are trying to do is to remind all leaders how important it is to sustain good relations at a time in which the world is counting on Asia, and particularly Northeast Asia, to fulfill its role with respect to the global economy, along the lines that Richard and Chris has already indicated. The U.S. position is, I think, principled and clear. We stand for strategic issues like freedom of navigation. We insist that problems be dealt with diplomatically, that parties do not resort to coercion or force, and that we, in certain circumstances, support a collaborative diplomatic process to deal with these issues. We've encouraged in the South China Sea a diplomatic process between ASEAN, the collection of Southeast Asian countries, and China to move towards a code of conduct, which we believe will ease tensions. And we have strongly supported efforts at diplomacy and dialogue between Tokyo and Beijing. These are among the most difficult issues on the global scene, we believe that we have played an appropriate role, oftentimes behind the scenes, to encourage calm and the maintenance of peace and stability.
I was going to say that one of the impacts you see of China's more nationalistic, assertive stance is the way it's affecting regional politics in each country, and Japan is a great example of that. You know, I think that has pushed Japan to the right. Mr. Abe might become prime minister again. When he became prime minister about, I guess, 5-6 years ago, on the first day that he became prime minister, he was greeted by Hu Jintao because he was considered to be so much better than Mr. Koizumi from a Chinese perspective. But he's running now on a much more nationalistic stance. But even by Japanese standards, he's not far to the right because Mr. Ishihara is even further to the right. So I feel the whole sort of spectrum in Japan has been pushed to the right, mainly as a result of dealing with China. And you can see the way that China is transforming the politics and the foreign policies of countries throughout the region.
You know, in your book, you talk a lot about, despite the efforts over the last decade to sort of fusicate, if that's a word, its pervasive role, the Chinese Communist Party is deeply involved in all aspects of Chinese society. Talk about that a little. I mean, you know, sometimes we forget that China is a communist country, as it were. It doesn't act much like the communists we knew about in the Cold War. But how pervasive is the Communist Party in the country today?
Of course, when you go to Beijing and you see the LVMH stores and the gleaming highways and Starbucks in the corner, yeah. I mean, I think people, Westerners, have a natural inclination to think they're all just like us. I think that's obviously not the case in China, certainly as far as the power structure goes. So if you look at how Chinese politics is organized, not so much Chinese society, because the Chinese economy has obviously been transformed massively in the past 30 years. Certainly Chinese society, you know, individual space has been dramatically increased. But Chinese politics, the Communist Party basically has a grip on every significant node of power, and that extends to beyond the government, to universities, to the media, to think tanks. You know, if the CSIS existed in China, Dr. Hamray would be appointed by the Communist Party. This would be a department. Now, that doesn't mean that you have a whole, you know, every single institution in the country is illiberal and people are all reading from the same script, but ultimately they've got the right to hire and fire throughout the system, right down from central, provincial, city, county governments. Until that is loosened, I think you won't see any significant change in the state's role in the economy on many other aspects as well.
We want to go to questions in the audience. So be thinking about your questions as you're thinking about them. I'll ask one question here. Let's talk about China's military. It has been modernizing. We hear about an aircraft carrier. What is the state of the Chinese military right mm-hmm. now?
Well, they've been embarked upon a crash military modernization program really for over a decade now. They've been seeing double-digit defense budget increases during that period for every year, save 2009, I believe, after the global financial crisis. So China's military has grown in size dramatically during that period. It has grown not only in size, but also in capability, in lethality, and in their ability to greatly complicate U.S. and other allied defense planning in the region for potential regional contingencies. What was interesting about the recent Party Congress that we've just seen is that there was also a major turnover in the military leadership, which didn't get anywhere near as much attention as the civilian leadership turnover, but may end up being almost as significant. For the first time ever, we have now a senior vice chairman of the military commission, the top military body in China who wears a uniform that isn't green. He's an Air Force officer. And that's a fundamental change for that military. It's been a ground-dominated military the entire time. And there are, of course, the other service commands are also represented on the CMC. This was something that was an evolution that took place in 2004 when the former president, Jiang Zemin, departed. So, you know, clearly they're moving toward a more externally focused military. That said, they remain the armed wing of the Communist Party of China, not the state army of China. And that's very significant. And like the party's role in the state and or in society and in the economy, it's easy to lose track of that. But the party never loses track of it and, in fact, reminds the military on a regular basis of that relationship. During the Arab Spring, for example, we saw an uptick in this sort of language. And this is one of the great inhibitors. They do a lot of writing on this within their military. They need to fundamentally restructure their force structure, for example. It's still a territorial defense force structure based on military regions designed for combat with the Soviet Union. They need to go to something more like our combined commands type structure. They recognize this. There are limits on that, however, because the military region structure does lend itself to possible internal suppression if that were to be necessary. It's far more suited to that. So there are tensions. There are psychic tensions in their military. Another key issue, I think, that you know leads me anyway not to fall into the school that views them as 100 feet tall is that there's a difference between having a robust technological capability, a good military kit, if you will, and then the more software side, which is training. Jointness in the true sense, like the U.S. military trains jointly and so on. China is far behind in these type of areas, and they've got a long way to go in terms of modernizing their military fully. But they're moving briskly, and they're certainly building capability at a pace that, you know, someone who's watched it for 20 years, we just had the test flights of their fighter for the aircraft carrier. I would argue that was well ahead of when I thought they would be able to accomplish that. So they've shown, I think, some real resilience in several of these areas. The question will be integration. How do they go about integration? And then the other key piece on the military modernization is transparency. When will they begin to be more transparent, you know, about what this is all for? You know, they're building such a large military, clearly, you know, more than capable of dealing with any possible contingency that they currently face. So it will help them tremendously, I think, to kind of do more public relations work, if you will, put out white papers, things of this nature, that demonstrate their claim that the rise of the military is appropriate to the rise of their national power.
Well, that was my next question. What is it for? What do we think it's for? I mean,
yeah. I think, you know, that it remains to be seen, but primarily, of course, they would argue that the purpose is to defend, you know, Chinese territory, obviously, first and foremost. They're quite clear, actually, in 2004, Hu Jintao, the departing president, fundamentally realigned the kind of military, key military guidelines, the so-called new historic missions of the PLA, and they've pretty directly pointed out what the intent is. Job number one is keep the Communist Party in power. They're very blunt about that and stating it that way, reminding them that they are the armed wing of the Communist Party. But there were two kind of new things that were added to this. One was protecting Chinese interests abroad, which is a new development for the Chinese military. You know, historically, that had not been their function. And then also this idea of sort of making the world safe for China's peaceful rise. That has a humanitarian and disaster relief component, I think, and peacekeeping. We're seeing them do more and more of that, their support for the anti-piracy mission in the Gulf of Aden, for example, those sort of things. But this idea of somehow protecting China's interests abroad and therefore, you know, sort of allowing or facilitating the rise of China's resurgence internationally, that has allowed elements like the Navy within the Chinese system to kind of push for greater, much greater development at a much better, a faster pace and a larger budget. And they're taking sort of a Mahanian approach to their military or their naval developments, and that'll be interesting to watch.
So one of the things that means for us, Bob, is that increasingly Chinese assets, naval and air, are operating further, farther from Chinese borders. The United States has, and its allies, has been a very active, we forward deploy in the Asian Pacific region. And as a result, our forces are going to operate in closer proximity on a much more regular basis. So one of the things that's most important, and you've seen what Secretary Panetta has done and the chairman and other key military leaders, is seek a deeper dialogue between our two military organizations, not just to get at this issue of transparency, which is of critical importance, but also to deal with issues associated with inadvertence and miscalculation. We do not want a situation where a local circumstance can lead to unintended consequences. And so as a result, we have sought to build in dialogues and discussions that will allow for greater communication in the event that there are challenges that arise in these areas.
All right. Well, why don't we go to the questions? All right. From the audience.
John Zan with CTI TV of Taiwan. Secretary Campbell, a simple question for you. Taiwan is a party to both the South China Sea dispute and the East China Sea dispute. What do you think, what kind of a role do you think Taiwan can play in calming down the situation or peacefully resolving the situation? President Ma has actually proposed a East China Sea peace initiative, calling for a bilateral and trilateral talks on the issue. What does the United States think of this proposal? Would it serve as a basis for dialogue? Thank you.
First of all, at a larger level, obviously one of the most important things that the United States seeks to convey is the determination to maintain peace and stability across the Taiwan Strait. We've also strongly supported the positive dialogue that has taken place over the last several years between the mainland and Taiwan. We seek that to continue. We also want to support our unofficial ties with Taiwan, particularly in the area of economic engagements. We have made very clear to all parties our position on these territorial matters. I articulated a position earlier, the maintenance of peace and stability, the desire to support freedom of navigation, and also the desire to see difficulties and disputes settled peacefully. We have had unofficial interactions with Taiwan authorities where we have underscored these positions clearly. And we expect Taiwan, along with other countries in the Asian Pacific region, to take steps not to provoke misunderstandings or tensions.
And may I just say here, let's address the questions just to the panel, not to the specific panelists, because, okay, the lady right here, go ahead. Here comes the microphone.
Thank you. My name is Jin Nguyen with Voice of Vietnamese Americans. I have one question with two parts, the short term and the long term. For the short term, would you give us the assessment of the current situation in the Southeast Asia Sea or South China Sea with the actions that China has taken with the visas, that including the U-shaped map that has a question regarding the defense of its own territory, and then also the fact that it has cut the cable of the Vietnamese Binh Minh ships recently, yesterday, I think, and it has also said that it would send out ships to prevent or take down or deter any ships that are entering the dispute areas, and that has caused a lot of reactions from the Philippines. That's the short term. The long term is to compete peacefully. What is the U.S. policy for Vietnam? Vietnam as a communist country, and we would like very much as Vietnamese Americans, as the diaspora, to support them to get into the TPP and to support the U.S. alignment approach. So what can the Vietnamese Americans diaspora help you? And how do you work the TPP out with the SOEs in Vietnam?
All right.
Thank you.
Let me tackle the short-term question by saying that I think what we're watching, what's been interesting, I think, and it comes back to the point I made earlier on, which is that I think we're still awaiting some high-level you know, interaction within the Chinese system on these issues. What's been interesting is that historically, when we've had these territorial disputes, it's been in one place or the other, the South China Sea or the East China Sea. China, in my sense, has done that quite deliberately to avoid the classic problem of dealing with two fronts at once. What's been quite interesting is that they seem to be willing, in this latest instance, to have this activity going on in two places at once, which is worrisome. Likewise, going back earlier this year, we had the situation where a series of actions, the establishment of Sancha City and the associated military garrison, the letting of blocks by the Chinese National Offshore Oil Company in what is clearly Vietnamese EEZ, these sort of issues. So we're seeing these cycles and waves of sort of Chinese activity here and assertiveness. And it goes back to what Richard said earlier about the smile diplomacy of the 1990s and early 2000s. I think what we're really watching to see here going forward is, you know, China's historical pattern, or at least over the last couple of years, has been there will be these bouts of assertiveness, and then there will be an effort, for lack of a better term, to press the reset button, you know, with Southeast Asia and go back to that more smile diplomacy. I think the challenge for China going forward is that each time they do that, you know, they think they're turning the page and the next page is blank, when in fact they're writing paragraphs on the next page, you know, each time something like this occurs. And again, I think we're going to have to see action from the top leadership to arrest, you know, some of this behavior. Or is this a new approach, you know, that we're seeing from the Chinese? I think we're going to have to watch that very, very closely going forward.
Let's see. Over here. Okay.
Hi, I'm Bill Gertz, national security journalist. My question's on the pivot. What do you say to critics who say that it lacks substance, that it's largely rhetorical, and in basketball terms, maybe a head fake instead of a pivot? And I would offer up three data points on that. One, you have an administration that really doesn't believe in leading from the front. You have a Defense Department that's cutting defense. We really haven't funded the air-sea battle. There's no dedicated budget for that. And in the intelligence community, there's kind of a groupthink on China, which has really prevented critical analysis and assessment of the threats and challenges.
Kurt. Thanks, Bill. Look, that's sort of diplomacy. Thanks, Bill. I believe that at a fundamental level that the process of rebalancing is a substantial effort that will take years and many administrations. And I believe it is fundamentally and profoundly in U.S. strategic interests. I will say I think there are other indicators that you might want to look at with regard to our overall engagement. The State Department proposal for our efforts in the Asian Pacific region are up very substantially. Budgets for USAID are up, much more substantial engagement in venues like the East Asia Summit, ASEAN Regional Forum. More activity diplomatically across the board in Asia and the Pacific. And so I think one of the points I would make for you is for you to broaden your interpretation of how you see American engagement. And I think you'll find that it's much more substantial. I also believe I've worked, as you know, for many years in the Pentagon. I believe that for very good reasons, over the last almost 15 years now, job one has been in securing critical ramparts in Afghanistan and Iraq and elsewhere. I can see very clearly strong determination among a new generation of officers to recognize the growing importance of the Asian Pacific region. And I also believe a similar dynamic is at work on Capitol Hill. So I believe the early indicators from the speeches and statements that Secretary Panetta has made, the chairman has made, Secretary Clinton and the president, underscores a determination to work in this direction. I believe that the down payments have been made, and it's been built on a very strong bipartisan commitment over decades. And I, at least, Bill, am confident that the United States understands the stakes and will make the appropriate investments over time.
All right. Right here. You. There you are.
Thank you. Dong Hui Yu with China Review News Agency of Hong Kong. I have a follow-up question on the South China Sea. And it was reported by the New York Times today that China and Vietnam had a new dispute over the energy exploration. And Vietnam accused a Chinese fishing boat of cutting off the cable of a Vietnamese vessel. Mr. Secretary, how would you respond to this new development? And also, while many people accuse Chinese reaction of more assertive, do you think exploring in a dispute water, the energy in a dispute water, is a good behavior to calm down the situation over there? Thank you.
Let me say, and this relates to the earlier question, obviously we have seen these new regulations having been issued in Hainan. They do raise some concerns, not just in the United States, but regionally. We have gone in at high levels and asked for clarification and underscored our overall policy of seeking to avoid provocations and to maintain peace and stability more generally. One of the challenges that we face, and Richard alluded to it, is that many people believe that some of these areas involve very potentially rich resources and reserves of natural gas and petroleum. I think in certain circumstances in the South China Sea and elsewhere, we have seen countries that have been able to come to terms on exploration and exploitation of potential reserves in circumstances in which sovereignty is still unresolved. That's extremely difficult. We recognize that. But ultimately, we encourage those kinds of discussions. They're not appropriate in all cases, but in some they might indeed be appropriate. Overall, we take a very strong stance on our view that under all circumstances that force provocations must be avoided.
Over here somewhere, right there, young man.
Hi, my name is Matt Schul. I'm a reporter with Inside U.S. Trade. I just wanted to ask a question on the issue of how we engage with China. We have a number of dialogues, including the Strategic and Economic Dialogue, which is partly involving the State Department. I believe there have been recommendations by some think tanks that we need to maybe change those dialogues, and maybe, you know, you all mentioned the visit of the vice president. These experts have maybe recommended having a sort of a vice presidential type of dialogue. And I was just wondering if, you know, you think that this is needed, or if this is something that the U.S. Would be interested in doing in order to make this dialogue more effective, and whether China and its new leadership would be open to that.
That's a good question, and it'll have to be our final question. Why don't we just go around the horn? Richard, why don't you start with and just kind of give us your final thoughts on that.
I feel loath to comment on U.S. What sort of level that the U.S. and China should be having a dialogue at. I mean, I think the initial dialogue, if I'm right, was started under President Bush. It was modified and broadened to include both Secretary of State and the Treasury Secretary under the Obama administration. Could it be elevated if it was at a vice presidential level? Perhaps that would be a greater level. But I think you should answer that.
Yeah. thanks for that. look, I would say the key feature over the last several years has been a very deep, sustained dialogue between the United States and China at every level. The president, the vice president, the strategic and economic dialogue, the various trade agencies involved in commerce and macroeconomic policy, and of course our military and strategic dialogues. I believe that over the course of the last several years, the strategic and economic dialogue has been extraordinarily effective, and some other dialogues that I've been involved in, like the Asia-Pacific consultations, have been important in establishing parameters of discussion and dealing with areas of both cooperation and areas of difference. I can assure you that we have a new team in China, and we're in the process of moving into a second term in the United States. I think you're going to want to let people make some determinations on the way forward. But I will assure you that the central feature of our approach will be extraordinarily sustained, deep dialogue going forward, probably built on the foundations that have been established. But I leave some of those details to the key players in both governments who are just now finding their new seats.
Chris, I'm going to give you the last word, and why don't you just kind of segue into what you think the state of relations is now between China and the United States, and what do you see in the days and years ahead?
I would just I would start off by amplifying some of what Kurt said earlier, which is and picking up on the S&ED theme. The relationship between China and the United States is extraordinarily difficult, but never has there been more discussion and high-level dialogue between the two sides, and this is fundamental. I think what we're seeing as we look at the challenge going forward, and what's been striking is that leaders on both sides recognize how complicated this is. Bob, you kicked us off with Graham Allison's observation as to how tricky this is. When Xi Jinping came here in February, he expressed a desire for a new style of great power relations between China and the United States. Exploring that concept, when I go to Beijing and asking people about it, there's not a lot of clarity on exactly what they mean, but I think what they're aiming for is something along the lines of the relationship is so important in the 21st century that it has to be elevated in some way to a higher plane above all of these disputes that we've been talking about in the trade sector, these island disputes, concerns about military developments on both sides, this sort of thing. Likewise, when Secretary Clinton was in Beijing in September, she also made reference to this by saying, I thought very artfully, that U.S. and China are trying to write a new answer to the longstanding question of how does a enduring power, and I like that she said an enduring power, not a status quo power in the United States, accommodate the ascent of a rising power like China without conflict. This is the fundamental challenge going forward. And my sense is, though, of course, that those kind of comments by both sides also underscore that at least both sides understand the possibility that there could be an old style of great power relations, a new Cold War, if you will, and that is to be fundamentally avoided. And I think there's a strong incentive on both leadership sides. The U.S. and China are interdependent in a way that the U.S. and the Soviet Union were not by any stretch of the imagination. And frankly, if the policy is currently set by the administration is somehow a containment policy, it's a terrible containment policy, right? It doesn't look like a containment policy at all, and China needs to understand this. So I think more dialogue, more discussion between the two sides, and elevating the level of the dialogue, I think, is useful in that what it does is it creates greater buy-in in both systems for working together cooperatively going forward, and that's going to be the challenge.
Well, thank you all very much, and on behalf of the Schufer School of Journalism and TCU, we thank you for coming. Thank you. Thank you.